Disc 10.
Martin pulled the Packard into the gas station at the edge of town and bought a bottle of spring water and an Allegheny County map, while Stella used the restroom. Heading out of town on 19, he felt her hand come to rest on his thigh. His body tensed. Real intimacy, the kind that comes after sex, was a strange bedfellow to Martin Odom. In his mind's eye, he thought of himself as being somewhere between Dante Pippin, who made love and war with the same frenetic energy, and Lincoln Ditman, who'd once gone off to Rome to try and find a whore he'd come across in Triple Border. Stella sensed the tenseness under her fingers. "I wasn't lying to Mrs. Sales," she remarked. "It did go very nicely, thank you. All things considered, last night was a great start to our sex life."
Martin cleared his throat. "I'm not comfortable talking about things like our sex life."
"Not asking you to talk about it," Stella shot back, laughter in her voice. "Expecting you to listen to me talk about it. Expecting you to mumble, uh-huh, once in a while in quiet encouragement."
Martin glanced at her and said, "Uh-huh."
The Packard sped past the billboard advertising the 1-800 number of the Virgin Mary. Half a mile beyond 305, they reached the junction with the signpost reading White Creek Road and Friendship. Martin turned onto White Creek and slowed down. When the highway dipped, he lost sight of the creek off to the right, only to spot it again when they topped a rise. In places, the rippling water of White Creek reminded him of the Lesnia, which ran parallel to the spur that connected Prigorodnaya to the Moscow-Petersburg Highway. The farmhouses along White Creek were set on the edge of the road to make it easier to get firewood and fodder in during the winter months when the ground was knee-deep in snow. The houses, spaced a quarter or a half mile apart, some of them with carpentry or broadloom workshops behind them and samples of what was being produced set out on raised platforms or porches, all had the electric meters and fuse boxes dangling off the clapboard walls. Amish going to market buggies could be seen in the garages, with cart mares grazing in adjoining fields. Occasionally children, dressed like little adults in their black suits or ankle-length dresses and bonnets and lace-up high shoes, would scamper out to the side of the road to stare shyly at the passing automobile. The MacGuffin Ridge turnoff loomed ahead, and Martin swung off White Creek. MacGuffin was a mirror image of White Creek. The road crossed rolling farm country, with farmhouses built close to the road, all of them with electric meters and lengths of black cable hanging off the walls. 3.5 miles into MacGuffin Ridge, Stella tightened her grip on Martin's thigh.
"I see them," he told her.
The Packard, moving even more slowly, came abreast of the two identical clapboard farmhouses built very close to each other. Across the road, a weathered barn stood atop a small rise. A crude American eagle, crafted out of metal, jutted from the ornate weather vane atop the mansard roof. Two Amish men in bibbed dungarees were sawing planks behind the first of the two houses. An Amish woman sat on a rocker on the porch, crocheting a patch quilt that spilled off near her feet. As the Packard passed the second house, Stella looked back and caught her breath.
"The electric meter is still attached to the house," she said.
"It's a perfect setup for somebody who wants to melt into the landscape," Martin said. "He can get the Amish woman next door to cook for him. If anybody comes nosing around when he's out, the Amish men will tell him. You didn't notice an automobile anywhere around the house?"
"No, maybe he goes to town by buggy like the Amish."
"Not likely. No car, no samat."
"What do we do now?" Stella asked as Martin drove on down the road.
"We wait until Samat comes back. Then we'll dust off your father's antique Tula Tokariev and go calling on him."
Martin pulled the Packard off the road beyond the next rise, and he and Stella walked back to a stand of maple on a butt of land. On the far side of the stand, it was possible to see the two houses and the barn across the road from them. Sitting on the ground facing each other with their backs against trees, they settled down to wait. Martin pulled Dante's lucky white silk scarf from a pocket and knotted it around his neck.
"Where did you get that?" Stella asked.
"Girl gave it to someone I know in Beirut. She said it would save his life if he wore it."
"Did it?"
"Yes."
"What happened to the girl?"
"She lost her life." Stella let that sink in. After a while, she said out of the blue,
"Kestner was murdered, wasn't he?"
Martin avoided her eye. "What makes you think that?"
"The FBI man Felix Kick told me."
"In so many words? He said your father didn't die of a heart attack?"
"This Felix Kick was a straight guy. Kestner trusted him. Me too, I trusted him."
"So did I," Martin agreed.
"I thought about it 1,000 times. I came at it from every possible direction."
"Came at what?"
"His letter. The actual autopsy doesn't mention the minuscule break in the skin near the shoulder blade. Mr. Kick's letter does.
He said it was compatible with an insect bite.
He was waving a red flag in front of my face, Martin. He was drawing my attention to something that was compatible with a lethal injection using a very thin needle. Kestner used to tell me about things like that. He said lethal injections were the KGB's favorite method of assassination. In his day, the KGB's hitmen favored a tasteless rat poison that thinned out the blood so much your pulse disappeared and you eventually stopped breathing. Kestner had heard they were working on more sophisticated substances that couldn't be easily traced. He told me they had developed a clotting agent that could block a coronary artery and trigger myocardial infarction. Don't pretend you didn't notice Keek's reference to the insect bite.
I noticed.
And?
Kick's the guy who suggested your father hire me to find Samat. Kick spent the better part of his FBI career in counterterrorism. He crossed paths with the company's deputy director of operations, Crystal Quest.
The one you called Fred when you first spoke to Kastner.
You have a good memory for things besides KGB jokes. Kick must have known Fred didn't want Samat found, and now Kick's waving the insect bite in front of our faces. Stella seemed relieved.
So you don't think I'm raving mad?
You're a lot of things. Raving mad is not one of them.
If I didn't know better, I might take that for a compliment.
Someone else was killed around the time your father was being stung by an insect. Her name was Min. Stella remembered the Israeli Shabak officer telling Martin about the Chinese girl who'd been stung to death by his bees on the roof over the pool parlor.
What does one death have to do with the other? She asked.
If your father was murdered, it means someone was trying to close down the search for Samat. Min was killed tending my hives, which means she was wearing my white overalls and the pith helmet with mosquito netting hanging from it when something made the bees explode out of one of the hives.
From a distance, she would have looked like you.
Something else occurred to her.
What about those shots when we were walking from Kiryat Arba to that sacred cave? You told me two bullets from a high-powered rifle came pretty close to you.
Could have been Palestinians shooting at Jews, Martin said. He didn't sound very convincing.
Maybe the same people who killed Kestner and your Chinese friend Min were shooting at you.
Uh-huh. The oligarch has a long reach, but we'll never know for sure.
Oh, Martin, I think I'm frightened.
Join the world. I'm never not frightened. The long shadows that materialize immediately before sunset were beginning to stretch their tentacles across the fields. Martin, following his own thoughts, said,
You've changed the way I look at things, Stella. I used to think I wanted to spend the rest of my life boring myself to death.
For someone who wanted to bore himself to death, you sure gave a good imitation of living an exhilarating life.
Did I? Kiryat Arba, London, Prague, that Soviet island in the Aral Sea, that Lithuanian town rioting over who gets to keep the bones of some obscure saint? And then there's the whole story of Prigorodnaya and the 7-kilometer spur that leads to it. Some boring life.
You left out the most exhilarating part.
Which is?
You. Stella pushed herself away from the tree to crouch next to him and bury her face in his neck.
Fools rush in, she murmured, where angels fear to tread.
The sun had vanished behind the hills to the west, and a rose-gray blush had infused the sky overhead. When they spotted the headlights coming down MacGuffin Ridge Road from the direction of White Creek, Martin stood up and tugged Stella to her feet. The car appeared to slow as it neared the two farmhouses. It swung away from them to climb the dirt ramp leading to the barn. The figure of a man could be seen pulling open the barn doors and closing them after he'd parked the car inside. Moments later, a porch light flicked on across the road in the nearest of the two houses. The man let himself into the house. Lights appeared in the ground floor windows. Martin and Stella exchanged looks.
I don't want you to take any risks, Stella said flatly. If he's armed, the hell with my sister's divorce. Shoot him.
Martin smiled for the first time that day.
You sure you told jokes for the KGB? You sure you weren't one of their wet work specialists?
Wet work? Hit men, or in your case, hit women.
I told killer jokes, Martin. Hey, I'm more nervous now than I was last night. Let's get this over with.
In the gathering gloom, they made their way on foot down the white stripe in the middle of the road toward the two houses. Somewhere behind them, a dog barked, and a quarter of a mile further along MacGuffin Ridge, other dogs began to howl. Through the porch windows of the second house, Martin could see the Amish family sitting down to supper at a long table lit by candles. Everyone bowed their head as the bearded man at the head of the table recited a prayer. Martin checked the Tula Tokariev to be sure the safety was off, then climbed silently onto the porch ahead of Stella and flattened himself against the clapboard to one side of the front door. He motioned for Stella to come up and knock. Speaking English with a thick Russian accent, the man who lived in the house could be heard calling, "Is that you, Zacchaeus? I told you to bring the meal over at 8. It is not civilized to sit down to supper at the hour you Americans eat." The door opened, and a gaunt man, his face masked by a thick beard with only his seaweed-green eyes visible, regarded Stella through the screen. The porch light was above and behind her, and her face was lost in shadows. "Who are you?" he asked. "What is it you're doing out here this time of day?" Stella breathed, "Privyet, Samat." Samat gasped. "Chi," he whispered. "Что ты здесь делаешь?" Stella gazed directly into Samat's eyes. "It's him," she said. Martin stepped into view, the antique Tula Tokariev aimed at Samat's solar plexus. Stella opened the screen door and Martin stepped across the sill. Samat, white spittle forming at one corner of his thin lips, backed into the room. He held his hands wide, palms up, almost in greeting. "Yosef, thanks to God you are still among the living." He started to pose questions in Russian. Martin realized that Yosef, like Stella and Samat, was a Russian speaker. He, Martin, could grasp words and phrases, sometimes the gist of a sentence, but an entire conversation in Russian was more than he could handle. He cut Samat off in mid-sentence. "В Америка по-английски говорят." In America, English is spoken. "What are you doing with her?" Samat looked from one to the other. "How is it possible you know each other?" Stella seemed as dazed as Samat. "Don't tell me you two know each other." "Our paths have crossed," Martin told her. Samat sank onto a couch. "How did you find me, Estelle?" Martin pulled over a wooden chair and, setting it back to front, straddled it, facing Samat, the handgun resting on one of the slats in the high back and pointed at his chest. Settling onto a bar stool, Stella flipped the picture postcard at Samat's feet. Retrieving it from the floor, he took in the photograph, then turned it over to look at the post office cancellation stamp. "Zacchaeus was supposed to mail this from Rochester," he whined. "The son of a bitch never went further than Belfast. No wonder you found the two houses on McGuffin Ridge." He looked intently at Martin, then at the postcard. "Yosef, you went back to Prigorodnaya. You saw my mother." "Why is he calling you Yosef?" demanded Stella, utterly mystified. Martin kept his eyes locked on Samat's. "I missed you by a day or two. The priest said you'd flown off in your helicopter after delivering the tiny cross carved from the wood of the true cross." "Must you point that weapon at me?" Stella answered for him. "He definitely must, if only to make me feel better." Mopping his brow with the back of a sleeve, Samat asked, "Yosef, how much do you remember?" "All of it." In his mind's eye, Martin could visualize the first black-and-white photograph the Russian interrogator in Moscow had shown him. An emaciated figure of a man, whom the Russian identified as Kafkor, Yosef, could be seen stark naked with a crown of thorns on his head, wading toward shore from the rowboat, the two guards in striped shirts following behind him. "I remember every detail. I remember being tortured for so long I lost count of time." Stella leaned forward. She was beginning to grasp why Martin considered himself to be imperfectly sane. "Who tortured you?" she asked in a whisper. "The men in striped shirts," Martin said, "the ex-paratroopers who guarded the Dacha in Prigorodnaya, who brought me across the river," he eyed Samat. "I remember the cigarettes being stubbed out on my body. I remember the large safety pin attached to a fragment of cardboard bearing the words 'The Spy Kafkor' being passed through the flesh between my shoulder blades. I remember being brought across the Lesnia with all the road workers gaping at me. I remember the guards prodding me up the incline to the crater that had been gouged into the spur of road." Samat started hyperventilating. When he could speak again, he said, "I beg you to believe me, Yosef. I would have saved you if it had been within the realm of possibility." "Instead, you gave Kafkor the spy a last cigarette." "You do remember." Stella looked from one to the other. She could almost hear her father instructing her that in the life of espionage operatives, questions would always outnumber answers. Samat started to reach into a cardigan. Martin thumbed back the hammer on the handgun. The click reverberated through the room. Samat froze. "I absolutely must smoke a cigarette," he said weakly. He held the cardigan open and reached very slowly into an inside pocket and extracted a pack of Marlboros. Pulling one cigarette free, he struck a wooden match and brought the flame to the end of the cigarette. His hand shook, and he had to grip his wrist with the other hand to steady it and hold the flame to the cigarette. Sucking it into life, he held it away from his body between his thumb and third finger and watched the smoke spiral up toward the overhead light fixture. "What else do you remember, Yosef?" Martin could almost hear the husky voice of the Russian interrogator who went by the legend Arkhip Cheklashvili. He repeated what Cheklashvili had told him back in Moscow. At moments, his own voice and that of the interrogator overlapped in his head. "Prigorodnaya's tractor repairman drove me to Moscow in the village's tow truck. His intention was to take me to a hospital. At a red light on the ring road, not far from the American embassy, I leaped from the cab of the truck and disappeared in the darkness."
"Yes, yes, it all fits," Samat blurted out. "Mrs. Quest sent us word. She told my uncle Tsvetan and me that the FBI counterintelligence people stationed at the Moscow embassy found you wandering in the back streets off the ring road. She said you couldn't remember who you were or what had happened to you. She spoke of a trauma. She said it was better for everyone if you couldn't remember."
"Oh, you fooled them, Yosef."
Samat started to whimper. Tears glistened on his skeletal cheeks.
"If she had suspected you of remembering, you would not have been permitted to leave Moscow alive."
I sensed that. I knew everything depended on convincing her I was suffering from amnesia.
"It was the oligarch who ordered them to torture you," Samat said with sudden vehemence. "He was convinced you had betrayed the Prigorodnaya operation. He needed to know to whom. Mrs. Quest needed to know to whom. It was a matter of damage control. If rot had set in, we needed to burn it out, so my uncle said. I tried to reason with him, Yosef. I told him you might have denounced the operation when you came to realize what it consisted of, but only to people on the inside. Only to Crystal Quest. I swore you would never go to the newspapers or the authorities. I told him you could be brought around to see things from our point of view. After all, we all worked for the same organization, didn't we? We all marched to the same music. It wasn't our business to pass judgment on the operation. The CIA gave us a compass heading and off we went. You were a soldier like me, like my uncle. You were the link between us and Mrs. Quest, between us and Langley."
Martin had to lure Samat into filling in the blanks. "It was the scope of the Prigorodnaya operation that sickened me," he said. "Nothing like that had ever been attempted before." Samat's head bobbed restlessly. Words spilled out, as if the sheer quantity of them filling the air would create a bond between him and the man he knew as Yosef.
"When the CIA found my uncle Tsvetan, he was running a used car dealership in Armenia. What attracted them to him was that his father and grandfather had been executed by the Bolsheviks. His brother, my father, had died in the camps. He himself had spent years in a Siberian prison. Tsvetan detested the Soviet regime and the Russians who ran it. He was ready to do anything to get revenge. So the CIA bankrolled him. With their money, he cornered the used car market in Moscow. Then, with the help of CIA largesse, I'm talking hundreds of millions, he branched out into the aluminum business. He made deals with the smelters. He bought 300 railroad cars. He built a port facility in Siberia to offload alumina. Before long, he had cornered the aluminum market in Russia and amassed a fortune of dozens of billions of dollars. And still his empire grew. He dealt in steel and chrome and coal. He bought factories and businesses by the dozens. He opened banks to service the empire and launder the profits abroad. Which is where I came in. Tsvetan trusted me completely. I was the only one who understood how the oligarch's empire was configured. It was all here in my head."
Then, once Tsvetan had established himself as an economic force, the CIA pushed him into politics.
"If my uncle ingratiated himself with Yeltsin, it was because he was following Mrs. Quest's game plan. When Yeltsin wanted to publish his first book, Tsvetan arranged the contracts and bought up the print run. The Yeltsin family suddenly discovered that they held shares in giant enterprises. Thanks to the oligarch, Yeltsin became a rich man. When Yeltsin ran for president of the Russian Federation in 1991, Tsvetan financed the campaign. Tsvetan was the one who funded Yeltsin's personal bodyguard, the Presidential Security Service. It was only natural that when Yeltsin sought advice, he would turn to the leading figure in his inner circle, the oligarch."
Martin began to see where the Prigorodnaya plot was going. Yeltsin's disastrous decision to free prices and willy-nilly transform Russia into a free market economy in the early 90s unleashed hyperinflation and wiped out the pensions and savings of tens of millions of Russians. It threw the country into economic chaos.
The concept originated with Crystal Quest's DDO people. My uncle was the one who convinced Yeltsin that a free market economy would cure Russia's ills.
The privatization of Soviet industrial assets, which looted the country's wealth and funneled it into the hands of the oligarch and a handful of insiders like him. Samat was scraping his palms together.
It all came from the CIA's operations directorate. The hyperinflation, the privatization, even Yeltsin's decision to attack Chechnya and bog down the Russian army in a war they couldn't win. You can understand where the Americans were coming from. The Cold War was over, for sure, but America did not defeat the mighty Soviet Union only to have a mighty Russia rise like a phoenix from its ashes. People at Langley could not take the risk that the transition from socialism to capitalism might succeed. So they got the oligarch, who detested the communist apparatchiki, who was only happy to see Russia and the Russians sink into an economic swamp, to use his considerable influence on Yeltsin.
Stella, watching Martin intently, saw him wince. For an instant she thought his leg must be acting up again. Then it dawned on her that the pain came from what Samat was saying. Martin had found the naked truth buried in Samat's story. She had too.
"The CIA was running Russia," she exclaimed.
"It was running Russia into the ground," Martin agreed.
"That was the beauty of it," Samat said, his voice shrill with jubilation. "We paid the Russians back for what they did to the Ugorzhilovs."
Martin remembered what Crystal Quest had said to him the day she summoned him to Singh's Mandarin restaurant under the pool hall. "We didn't hire your conscience, only your brain and your body. And then one fine day you stepped out of character. You stepped out of all your characters and took what in popular idiom is called a moral stand." At the time, Martin didn't have the foggiest idea what she was talking about. Now the pieces of the puzzle had fallen into place. Now he understood why they'd convened a summit at Langley to decide whether to terminate his contract or his life. Samat, drained, puffed on the cigarette to calm his nerves. Martin found himself staring at the ash at the tip of Samat's cigarette, waiting for it to buckle under its own weight and fall. Life itself seemed to ride on it. Defying gravity, defying sense, it grew longer than the unsmoked part of the cigarette. Martin associated the ash with the naked man kneeling at the edge of the crater, the one who had been caught in the black and white photograph, peering over his shoulder, his eyes hollow with terror. Samat, sucking on the cigarette, became aware of the ash too. His words slurring with dread, he whispered,
"Please, I ask you, Yosef, for the sake of my mother, who loved you like a son, do not shoot me."
"I'm not sure you should shoot him," Stella said. "Then again, I'm not sure you shouldn't. What is to be accomplished by shooting him?"
"Revenge is a manifestation of sanity. Shooting him would make me feel perfectly sane."
Martin looked back at Samat, who was breathing noisily through his mouth, terrified that each breath would be his last. "Where is the oligarch?" Martin asked.
"I do not know."
Martin raised the Tula Tokariev to eye level and sighted on Samat's forehead, directly between his eyes. Stella turned away. "When you lived in Kiryat Arba," Martin reminded Samat, "you spent a lot of time on the phone with someone who had a 718 area code."
"The phone records were destroyed. How could you know this?"
Stella remembered seeing one of your phone bills.
"I swear to you on my mother's head, I do not know where the oligarch is. The 718 number was the home phone of the American manufacturer of artificial limbs that I imported to London for distribution to war zones."
Tears welled in Samat's seaweed-green eyes.
"For all I know, the oligarch may no longer be alive. In the witness protection program, these things are tightly compartmented, precisely so that no one can get to him through me, or to me through him."
Stella said very quietly,
"He may be telling the truth."
Samat clutched at the buoy Stella had thrown him.
"I never meant to harm you," he told her. "The marriage to your sister was a matter of convenience for both of us. She wanted to live in Israel, and I had to get out of Russia quickly. I was incapable of sleeping with Yara. You have to comprehend. A man can only be a man with a woman."
"Which narrowed it down to Stella," Martin said. Samat avoided his eye.
"A normal man has normal appetites."
Martin held the pistol unwaveringly for several long seconds, then slowly let the front sight drop. "Your other uncle, the one who lives in Caesarea, claims you stole $130 million from six of his holding companies. He offered me $1 million to find you.
Samat glimpsed salvation.
I will pay you $2 million not to find me.
I don't accept checks. Samat saw that he might be able to worm his way out of this predicament after all.
I have bearer shares hidden in the freezer of the icebox.
There is one other matter that needs to be arranged, Martin informed him. Confidence began seeping back into Samat's voice.
Only name it, he said, all business.
Stella spent the better part of next morning on Samat's phone trying to track down an Orthodox rabbi who would accommodate them. An old rabbi in Philadelphia gave her the number of a colleague in Tenafly, New Jersey. A recorded announcement at the Chabad Lubavitch synagogue there suggested anyone calling with a weekend emergency try the rabbi's home number, which rang and rang without anyone answering. A rabbi at Beth Hakness's Hachodish in Rochester knew of a rabbi at Ezrat Israel in Ellenville, New York, who delivered religious divorces, but when Stella dialed the number, she fell on a teenage daughter. Her father, the rabbi, was away in Israel, she said. He did have a cousin who officiated at B'nai Jacob in Middletown, Pennsylvania. If this was an emergency, Stella could try phoning him. It was the Middletown rabbi who suggested she call Abraham Shulman, the rabbi at the Beth Israel Synagogue in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. Rabbi Shulman, an affable man with a booming voice, explained to Stella that what she needed was an ad hoc rabbinical board composed of three Orthodox rabbis to deliver the scroll of the get and witness the signatures. As luck would have it, he was sitting down to Sunday brunch with two of his colleagues, one from Manhattan, the other from the Bronx, both of them, like Shulman, Orthodox rabbis. Oh dear, yes, it was unusual, but the rabbinical board could witness the signing of the get by the husband even if the wife were not physically present, and then forward the document to the wife's rabbi in Israel for her signature, at which point the divorce would become final. Rabbi Shulman inquired how long it would take her and the putative husband to reach Crown Heights. Stella told the rabbi they could be there by late afternoon. She jotted down his directions. Cross over from Manhattan to Brooklyn on the Manhattan Bridge. Follow Flatbush Avenue down to Eastern Parkway, then follow Eastern Parkway until you reached Kingston Avenue. The synagogue filled the top three floors of number 745 Eastern Parkway on your left coming from New York, immediately after Kingston Avenue. The three rabbis, looking somewhat worse for brunch, were holding court in Shulman's murky, book-lined study on the ground floor under the synagogue. Shulman, the youngest of the three, was clean-shaven with apple-shiny cheeks. The two other rabbis had straggly white beards. All three wore black suits and black fedoras propped high on their foreheads. On the two older rabbis it looked perfectly natural. On Shulman it produced a comic effect. "Which of you?" boomed Shulman, looking from Samat to Martin and back to Samat. "Is the lucky future X?" Martin, one hand gripping the Tula Tokarev in his jacket pocket, prodded Samat in the spine. "Who would believe," Samat said under his breath as he shuffled across the thick carpet, "you went to all this trouble to find me for a divorce."
"Did you say something?" inquired the rabbi to the right of Shulman. "It is me, the divorcer," Samat announced.
"What's the mad rush to divorce?" the third rabbi asked. "Why couldn't you wait until the shul opens on Monday morning?"
Stella improvised.
"He's booked on a flight to Moscow from Kennedy Airport this evening."
"There are Orthodox rabbis in Moscow," Shulman noted.
In a bamboo cage set on a wooden stepladder next to floor-to-ceiling bookshelves, a green bird with a hooked bill and bright red plumes between its eyes hopped onto a high trapeze and declared, clear as a bell,
"Losim Zain, Losim Zain."
Rabbi Shulman looked embarrassed.
"My parrot speaks Yiddish," he explained. "Losim Zain means let him be."
He smiled at his colleagues.
"Maybe Hashem, blessed be his name, is trying to tell us something."
The rabbi turned back to Samat. "I assume you wouldn't come all this way without identification." Samat handed his Israeli passport to the rabbi.
"You are Israeli?" Shulman said, plainly surprised. "You speak Hebrew?"
"I immigrated to Israel from the Soviet Union. I speak Russian."
"The Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore," Shulman pointed out.
"I meant Russia, of course," Samat said.
"Excuse me for asking," the oldest of the three rabbis said, "but you are Jewish."
"My mother is Jewish, which makes me Jewish. The Israeli immigration authorities accepted the proofs of this when they let me into the country."
Stella explained the general situation while Shulman took notes. Her sister, whose Israeli name was Yara, daughter of the late Oscar Alexandrovich Kastner of Brooklyn, New York, currently lived in a Jewish settlement on the West Bank called Kiryat Arba.
Yara and Samat Ugorzhilov, here present, had been married by the Kiryat Arba rabbi, whose name was Ben Zion. Stella herself had been a witness at the marriage ceremony. Samat had subsequently abandoned his wife without granting her a religious divorce. The same Samat, here present, had had second thoughts about the matter and is now willing to put his signature to the document granting a religious divorce to his wife. She stepped forward and handed the rabbis a scrap of paper which spelled out the terms of the divorce. Samat's signature was scrawled across the bottom. The resplendent parrot descended to the lower trapeze and cried out, "Nu schön, nu schön," Schulman said. "That's the Yiddish equivalent of let's put the show on the road." One of the older rabbis looked across the room at Martin.
"And who are you?"
"That's a good question, Rabbi," Martin said.
"Perhaps you would like to answer it," Schulman suggested.
"My name is Martin Odom." Looking straight at Martin, Stella said, "He has deeper layers of identity than a name, Rabbi. Fact is, he's not absolutely sure who he is. But so what? Women fall for men all the time who don't know who they are."
Schulman cleared his throat. The three rabbis bent over Samat's passport.
"The photograph in the passport doesn't look anything like this gentleman," one of the rabbis observed.
"I did not have a beard when I came to Israel," Samat explained. Stella said, "Look carefully. You can tell by the eyes it's the same man."
"Only women are able to identify men by their eyes," Schulman remarked. He addressed Samat. "You affirm that you are the Samat Ugorzhilov who is married to," he glanced at his notes, "Yara Ugorzhilov of Kiryat Arba?"
"He does affirm it," Stella said.
The rabbi favored her with a pained look. "He must speak for himself."
"I do," Samat said.
He glanced at Martin, leaning against the wall near the door with one hand in his jacket pocket.
"I affirm it."
"Is there any issue from this marriage?"
When Samat looked confused, Stella translated. "He's asking if you and Yara had children."
She addressed Schulman directly.
"The answer is you can't have children when you don't consummate the marriage."
One of the older rabbis chided her.
"Lady, given that he is not contesting the divorce, I think you are telling us more than we need to know."
Schulman said, "Do you, Samat Ugorzhilov, here present, stand ready to grant your wife, Yara Ugorzhilov, a religious divorce, what we call a get, of your own free will and volition, so help you God?"
"Yes, yes, I will give her the damned get," Samat replied impatiently. "You guys use a lot of words to describe something as uncomplicated as a divorce."
"Kabbalah teaches us," Schulman noted as his two colleagues nodded in agreement, "that God created the universe out of the energy and words. Out of the energy of your words, Mr. Ugorzhilov, we will create the divorce."
Stella smiled at Martin across the room.
"It doesn't come as a surprise to me that words have energy."
Samat looked bewildered.
"Who is this Kabbalah character and what does he have to do with my divorce?"
"Let's move on," Schulman suggested. "Under the terms of the get," he went on, reading from Stella's scrap of paper, "your wife will keep any and all property and assets that you may possess in Israel, including one split-level house in the Jewish settlement of Kiryat Arba, including one Honda automobile, including any and all bank accounts in your name in Israeli banks."
"I have already agreed to this. I signed the paper."
"We must ascertain verbally that you understand what you have signed," explained Schulman.
"That you were not coerced into signing," added one of his colleagues.
"According to the terms of the divorce," the rabbi continued, "you are putting on deposit with this rabbinical board $1 million in bearer shares, with the intention that the said $1 million, less a generous $25,000 donation to a Jewish program to relocate Jews to Israel, will be transferred to the ownership of your wife, Yara Ugorzhilov."
Samat glanced at Martin, who nodded imperceptibly.
I agree to it all," Samat said hurriedly.
"That being the case," the rabbi said, "we will now prepare the scroll for the get for your signature. The document, along with the $975,000 in bearer shares, will be sent by Federal Express to Rabbi Ben Zion in Kiryat Arba. Yara will be summoned before a rabbinical board there to sign the get, at which point you and your wife will be formally divorced."
"How long will it take to prepare the scroll?" Martin asked from the door.
45 minutes, give or take," Schulman said. "Can we offer you gentlemen and the lady coffee while we prepare the document?"
Later, Martin and Samat waited outside the synagogue while Stella brought around the Packard. Martin slid into the back seat alongside Samat.
"Where are we off to now?" Stella asked.
"Take us to Little Odessa." "Why are we going to the Russian section of Brooklyn?" Stella asked.
"Get us there and you'll see," Martin said. Stella shrugged.
"Why not?" she said. "You certainly knew what you are doing up to now."
She piloted the large Packard through rush-hour traffic on Ocean Parkway, past block after block of nearly identical gray, grim tenements with colorful laundry flapping from the lines on the roofs. Twice Sama tried to start a conversation with Martin, who sat with the butt of the Tula Tokariev in his right fist and his left hand gripping Samat's right wrist. Each time Martin cut him off with a curt, up front, Stella had to laugh.
"You won't get far with him when he's in one of his aha moods," she called over her shoulder.
"Turn left when you get to Brighton Beach Avenue," Martin instructed her. "It's the next traffic light."
"You've been here before," Samat said.
"Had two clients in Little Odessa before I became a famous international detective tracking down missing husbands," Martin said. "One involved a kidnapped Rottweiler. The other involved a neighborhood crematorium run by Chechen immigrants." Samat pulled a face.
"I do not comprehend why America lets Chechens into this country. The only good Chechens are dead Chechens."
Stella asked Samat, "Have you been to Chechnya?"
Samat said, "Did not need to go to Chechnya to come across Chechens. Moscow was swarming with them."
Martin couldn't resist. "Like the one they called the Ottoman." The seaweed in Samat's eyes turned dark, as if they had caught the reflection of a storm cloud.
"What do you know about the Ottoman?"
"I know what everyone knows," Martin said guilelessly. "That he and his lady friend were found one fine morning hanging upside down from a lamppost near the Kremlin wall."
"The Ottoman was not an innocent."
"I heard he'd been caught doing 50 in a 40-kilometer zone." Samat finally figured out his leg was being pulled.
"Speeding in Moscow can be dangerous for your health," he agreed. "Also littering."
"Turn left on Fifth Avenue, just ahead. Park on the left where it says no parking any time."
"In front of the crematorium?"
Stella asked as she turned into the street.
"Who are we meeting?"
Samat inquired uneasily as Stella eased the Packard alongside the curb and killed the motor.
"It's almost 8, Martin said. "We'll wait here until it's dark and the streets are empty."
"I'm going to close my eyes for a few minutes," Stella announced.
Stella's 40 winks turned into an hour and 10-minute nap. All the driving she'd done that day, not to mention the worrying, had taken its toll on her. Samat, too, dozed, or appeared to, his chin sinking onto his chest, his shut eyelids fluttering. Martin kept a tight grip on the butt of the Tula Tokariev. Curiously, he didn't feel bushed, despite his having slept fitfully on Samat's couch the night before. Woken every few hours by Samat calling from the locked closet that he needed to go to the toilet. What kept Martin alert, what kept the adrenaline flowing, was his conviction that revenge was a manifestation of sanity. That if he played this thing out, his days of being imperfectly sane were numbered. As darkness settled over Little Odessa, the Russians began heading back to their apartments. Behind them, on Brighton Beach Avenue, traffic thinned out. Lights appeared in windows on both sides of Fifth Street. The bulb in the vestibule of the funeral parlor across the street came on. Two floors above the door with the gold lettering that read Akhtan Abdulkadjiev and Sons, Crematorium, an elaborate chandelier fitted with Christmas tree bulbs blazed into life, and the scratchy sound of an accordion playing melodies that sounded decidedly Central Asian drifted out of an open window. A lean man and a teenage boy dragged a pushcart filled with tins of halava down the middle of the street and turned into one of the driveways near the end of the block. Two young girls, skipping rope as they made their way home, passed the Packard. An old woman carrying a Russian navoska filled with vegetables hurried up the steps of a nearby brownstone. When the street appeared deserted, Martin leaned forward and nudged Stella on the shoulder. She angled her rearview mirror so that she could see Martin in it.
"How long did I sleep?"
"A few minutes." Samat's eyes blinked open and he swallowed a yawn. He looked up and down the street.
"I do not understand why we have come to the Russian section of Brooklyn," he said anxiously. "If it is to meet someone..."
Martin could hear a voice in his ear.
"For once in your life, don't weigh the pros and cons. Just act violently."
"Dante?"
"You don't want to shoot him, Martin. Too noisy. Use the butt. Break his kneecap."
Stella said, "Who are you talking to, Martin?"
"Don't think about it. Just do it, for Christ's sake."
"I'm talking to myself," Martin murmured. He was sorely tempted to jailbreak, to set foot outside the Martin Odom legend, to become, if only for an instant, someone as impulsive as Dante Pippin. Clutching the Tula Tokariev by the barrel, Martin slammed the grip down hard on Samat's right knee. The sharp crunch of the bone splintering filled the Packard.
Samat stared in disbelief at his knee as a brownish stain soaked into the fabric of his trousers. Then the pain reached his brain and he cried out in agony. Tears spurted from his eyes. Stella twisted in the seat, breathing hard.
Martin, have you gone mad?
I'm going sane. Samat, cradling his shattered kneecap with both hands, thrashed in pain. Martin said very softly, "You killed Kastner, didn't you?"
"Get me a doctor!"
"You killed Kastner," Martin repeated. "Admit it, and I will put an end to your suffering."
"I had nothing to do with Kastner's death. The oligarch had him eliminated when the Quest woman told him you were trying to find me. My uncle and Quest, they wanted to cut off all the leads."
Stella said, "How did the killers get into the house without breaking a door or a window?"
"Quest supplied the keys to the doors and the alarm box."
"You killed the Chinese girl on the roof, too," Martin said. Samat's nose began to run.
"Quest's people told the oligarch about the beehives on the roof. He sent a marksman to the roof across the street. The marksman mistook the Chinese girl for you. Her death was an accident."
"Where is the oligarch?"
"For the love of God, I must get to a doctor."
"Where is the oligarch?"
"I told you, I do not know."
"I know you know."
"We speak only on the phone."
"The 718 number?" When Samat didn't say anything, Martin reached across Samat and pushed open the door on his side of the car. "Read the name on the crematorium door," he ordered. Samat tried to make out the name through the tears blurring his vision.
"I cannot see."
"It says Akhtan Abdulkadjev. Abdulkadjev is a Chechen name. The crematorium is the Chechen business that was accused of extracting gold teeth before cremating the corpses. If you don't give me the phone number, I'll push you out of the car and ring the bell and tell the Chechens sitting down to supper upstairs that the man who hanged the Ottoman upside down from a lamppost in Moscow is on their doorstep. There isn't a Chechen alive who doesn't know the story, who won't jump at the chance to settle old scores."
"No, no, the number is 718-555-9291.
"If you're lying, I'll break your other knee."
"Oh, my mother's head, I swear it. Now take me to a doctor."
Martin got out of the Packard and came around to the other side of the car and, taking a grip on Samat's wrists, pulled him from the back seat across the sidewalk. He propped Samat up so that he was sitting on the sidewalk with his back against the door. Then Martin pressed the buzzer for several seconds. 2 floors over his head, a young woman appeared in the open window.
"Crematorium closed for the day," she shouted down.
"Crematorium about to open," Martin called back.
"You ever hear of a Chechen nicknamed the Ottoman?"
The woman in the window ducked back into the room. A moment later, the needle was plucked off the record. 2 men stuck their heads out of the window.
"What about the Ottoman?" an older man with a flamboyant mustache yelled down.
"The Armenian from the Slovak Alliance who lynched him and his lady friend within sight of the Kremlin is on your doorstep. His name is Samat Ugarzhilov. Your Chechen friends have been looking all over the world for him. There's no rush to come get him. He's not going anywhere on a shattered knee."
Samat whimpered,
"For the love of God, for the sake of my mother, you cannot leave me here."
Martin could sense the excitement in the room above his head. Footsteps could be heard thundering down the stairs. "Start the motor," he called to Stella. A current of pain shot through his game leg as he made his way around the car and climbed in next to the driver. "Let's go," he said. "Don't run any red lights." Stella, biting her lip to keep from trembling, steered the Packard away from the curb and headed down the empty street. Martin turned in the seat to watch the Chechens drag Samat into the crematorium. Stella must have seen it in her rearview mirror.
"Oh, Martin," she said, "what will they do to him?"
"I suppose they will extract the gold teeth from his mouth with a pair of pliers and then put him in one of their cheapest coffins and nail the lid shut and light off the burning fiery furnace and cremate him alive."
He touched the back of her hand on the steering wheel. "Samat left behind him a trail of blood. The Ottoman and his lady friend, your father, my Chinese friend Min, the scavengers locked in cages on an island in the Aral Sea who died miserably when Samat used them as guinea pigs to test bio-warfare viruses that he eventually gave to Saddam Hussein. The list is long." Using hand gestures, Martin directed Stella back into the heart of Brooklyn. When they reached Eastern Parkway, he had her pull over to the curb. He retrieved the paper bag from the trunk and, taking her arm, drew her to a bench on one side of the parkway. "There's $1 million in bearer shares left in the bag," Martin explained, handing it to her. "Go to ground in a motel on the Jersey side of the Holland Tunnel for the night. Tomorrow, drive to Philadelphia and go to the biggest bank you can find and cash these in and open an account in your name. Then drive to Jonestown in Pennsylvania. Not Johnstown, Jonestown. Find a small house, something with white clapboard and storm windows and a wraparound porch at the edge of town and a view across the cornfields. It needs to have a yard where we can raise chickens. There's a monastery not far away over the rise. You want to be able to hear its carillon bells from the house.
How do you know about Jonestown and the monastery?
Lincoln Dittman and I both come from Jonestown. Funny part is we didn't know each other back then. My family moved to Brooklyn when I was 8, but Lincoln was brought up in Pennsylvania. I'd almost forgotten about Jonestown. He reminded me.
Who's Lincoln Dittman?
Someone I came across in another incarnation.
What do I do when I find the house?
Buy it.
Why don't you come with me?
I have some loose ends to take care of. I'll turn up in Jonestown when I've finished.
How will you find me?
Jonestown is a small town. I'll ask for the gorgeous dish with a permanent squint in her eyes and the ghost of a smile on her lips. Stella relished the coolness of the night air. The headlights streaking past led her to imagine that she and Martin were stranded on an island of stillness in a world of perpetual motion.
Do you really remember what happened to you in Moscow? She asked.
He smiled. No. A curtain screened off the fragment of my life that I lived under the legend Josef Kafkor. But what I've lost won't change anything for us. The part of Martin Odom's life that I want to remember begins here. 1997. Lincoln Dittman connects the dots.
U.S. Government Printing Office Annex. Harvey Cleveland speaking. How can I help you?
Do you recognize my voice, Felix?
Tell you the truth, no. Am I supposed to?
Does a hangar under the Pulaski Skyway ring a bell? A crazy Texan named Leroy was about to shoot you. You jumped a mile when you heard his wrist bone splinter.
Felix's kick could be heard chuckling into the phone.
Speak of the devil, he said. Lincoln Dittman, how'd you get this number? It's supposed to be an unlisted hotline.
How are you, Felix?
Hang on, I'm going to scramble this call.
There was a burst of static, then Felix's voice came online again, loud and clear.
I'm almost, but not quite retired. 6 weeks, 3 days, 4.5 hours to go, and I'm out of here. What about you?
I'm more or less okay.
Which is it, more or less?
More, actually.
Your memory coming back?
Nothing's wrong with my memory, Felix. You're confusing me with Martin Odom.
Lincoln's remark startled Felix.
I guess I am, he admitted warily.
You are Lincoln Dittman?
In the flesh.
Why are you calling?
I'm connecting the dots. I thought you could fill in some of the blanks.
Tell me what you know, he said guardedly. Maybe I'll hint at what you don't know.
I know what happened to Josef Kafkor in Prigorodnaya, Felix. He was the cutout between Crystal Quest's operation folks at the CIA and the oligarch, Tsvetan Ugorzhilov. When Josef figured out that Quest was part of the Prigorodnaya operation, when he figured out she originated the operation, he must have threatened to take the matter up with an assortment of congressmen or senators, at which point Josef was tortured and starved by the oligarch's hired hands, and eventually buried alive.
I'm hanging on your every word, Lincoln.
You were a counterterrorism wonk before they put you out to pre-retirement pasture, changing diapers for clients in the FBI's witness protection program. I seem to remember you'd been posted to the American Embassy in Moscow at one point in your career. Were you in Moscow when they brought in Josef Kafkor, Felix?
Lincoln could almost hear Kick smiling.
It's within the realm of possibility, the FBI man acknowledged.
With your rank, Lincoln said, talking rapidly, leaving precious little breathing space between sentences, you would have been the top FBI gun at the embassy. You would have picked up scuttlebutt about the DDO running a secret operation via a cutout. When Josef turned up on your doorstep, it would have crossed your mind that he could be the cutout. His physical condition, the evidence of torture on his body, his mental state would have suggested that the DDO operation had gone off the tracks.
Lincoln came up for air.
Why were the oligarch and Samet exfiltrated?
Felix actually sighed.
They'd been living on the edge for years. The Moscow gang wars, the Chechens, certain factions inside the Russian Federal Security Service— disgruntled KGB hands who found themselves out in the cold, Yeltsin's political enemies, wannabe capitalists whom the oligarch had ruined on his way up. Take your pick. And then Josef Kafkor comes on the scene. Josef and his scruples. Quest would have assured the oligarch that she was the only one who heard his qualms, but the Ugorzhilovs, Tsvetan and Samat, must have had their doubts. After all, Quest had a vested interest in lying to them to keep the operation up and running indefinitely.
When Yosef was rescued from the grave the oligarch dug for him and ended up wandering the streets of Moscow, the Ugor Zhilovs didn't swallow Quest's story that he couldn't remember the Yosef Kafkor legend. Samat cracked first. He didn't like the idea of coming to the States. He thought he'd be safer tucked away in a Jewish settlement on the west bank of the Jordan, so he got himself into Israel. The oligarch held on longer, but in the end he cracked too and they brought him in. Do the witness protection program? No way. He was too important for Quest to entrust to the FBI. Her DDO Wallace created a legend for the oligarch themselves and settled him somewhere on the east coast of America. Meanwhile, you had Kastner and his two daughters in your protection program. I liked Kastner. If it's any comfort, given that you lost him, he liked you. You're sprinkling salt in wounds, Lincoln. And the day Kastner told you, he referred to you as his friend in D.C., that he needed someone to track down Samat, you couldn't resist tempting fate, could you? I can imagine how the scenario played out after Moscow. Someone like you would have been fascinated by the man found wandering behind the embassy, his body covered with sores. You would have been intrigued by the CIA's immediate interest in him. You would have been curious to know what happened to Yosef Kafkor after he was smuggled out to Finland. You had friends at the CIA. You would have learned that the Yosef Kafkor exfiltrated to Finland on your watch had been reincarnated, so to speak, as Martin Odom. That this same Martin Odom wound up working as a private detective in Crown Heights. And so you gave Kastner Martin Odom's name. When Kick didn't confirm or deny this, Lincoln said, "Why?" "Why not? Come clean, Felix." This oligarch character and his nephew Samat rubbed me the wrong way. Crystal Quest rubbed me the wrong way. I still remember how arrogant she was when the FBI was obliged to turn the triple border action over to her. And there was no love lost between the FBI and the CIA in general. On top of that, there have to be limits. I mean, ruining the Russian economy. Lincoln said, "How'd you figure it out?" "All you had to do was look around you in Moscow. All you had to do was catch the smug smiles on the faces of the DDO Wallahs assigned to Moscow Station. Quest herself showed up several times. You couldn't miss the gleam of unadulterated triumph in her bloodshot eyes. They were involved in something very big, that much was apparent to everyone around. They were transforming the world, rewriting history. And we saw Yeltsin imposing these wild ideas that the newspaper said came from the oligarch. Freeing prices overnight, which led to hyperinflation. Privatizing the Soviet industrial base, which left Ugor Zhilov and a few insiders fabulously rich and the rest of the proletarians dirt poor. Attacking Chechnya, which bogged down the Russian military in the Caucasus. It didn't take a genius to put two and two together. Demolishing the Russian economy, impoverishing dozens of millions of people so that the United States wouldn't have to deal with a powerful Russia. Holy mackerel, it was over the top, Lincoln. So I guess I saw a certain poetic justice for Martin Odom to be the one to track down Samat for the divorce. I guess in the back of my head I wondered if Martin's memory wouldn't be jogged if and when he caught up with Samat. If Martin's memory was jogged, if he came to realize that he was Yosef, he would want revenge. Felix said carefully, any sane man in his shoes would. Kastner was murdered, wasn't he? Probably. The CIA insisted on doing the autopsy. I didn't like the way it played out. It was too neat by a half. Martin heads for Israel to pick up the trail of Samat. Kastner dies of a heart attack. And the Chinese girl wearing Martin's white jumpsuit winds up being stung to death by bees on the roof. You noticed that. I notice everything. So are you going to tell me, Lincoln, did Martin and Kastner's kid Estelle find Samat? What makes you think Estella's involved? Because you phoned me on this unlisted number. It had to come from somewhere. My guess, Felix added cautiously, feeling his way, is that Stella gave the number to Martin and Martin passed it on to you. Martin found Samat where you stashed him, upstate New York in the middle of Amish country. He persuaded him to give his wife a religious divorce. Some rabbis in Brooklyn did the paperwork. What happened to Samat after he signed on the dotted line? He said something about wanting to see Russian friends in Little Odessa. That's the last anyone saw of him, flagging down a taxi and telling the driver to take him to Brighton Beach. Now that Samat's been found, the case is closed. There's still the oligarch. You wouldn't by any chance know where he hangs his hat these days. I don't know. If I did, I wouldn't tell you. On the off chance you can find him, don't. Remember what happened to Yosef. Touch a hair on the oligarch's head, Quest and her Wallahs will bury you alive. Thanks for the free advice, Felix. You saved my life once, Lincoln. Now I'm trying to save yours. 1997. Lincoln Dittman feels the recoil in his shoulder blades.
The sanctum Lincoln had sussed out was as suitable as a sniper's blind gets. Most of the panes were missing from the window, which meant he could steady the Whitworth on a sash at shoulder height. Lincoln shot best standing up, with his left elbow braced against a rib. The window itself was covered with a canopy of ivy that had spread across the facade of the abandoned hospital across the street and slightly uphill from the U-shaped tenement at 621 Crown Street off Albany Avenue. For a sharpshooter, weather conditions, it was sunny and cold, were ideal. Humid air could slow down a bullet and cause it to drop. Dry, hot air could cause it to fire high. Lugging the rifle and a shopping bag up the stairs littered with broken glass and trash to the corner room on the fourth floor, Lincoln had removed the thick work gloves and coated all of his fingertips with superglue, then set out the bottles of drinking water, the Mars bars, and the containers of liquid yogurts on a sheet of newspaper. He knotted Dante Pippin's lucky white silk scarf around his neck before sighting in the Whitworth. He judged the distance from the front door of the hospital to the sidewalk in front of the tenement to be 80 yards, then calculated his height above ground and the length of the hypotenuse of the resulting triangle. He adjusted the small wheels on the rear of the brass telescopic sight atop the Whitworth, focusing on the crucifix hanging in a ground floor window giving out onto the street. Sighted correctly and fired with a firm arm, the hexagonal barrel of the Whitworth, rifled to spit out a .45 caliber hex-shaped lead bullet that made one complete turn every 20 yards, could hit anything the marksman could see. Queen Victoria herself had once gotten a bullseye at 400 yards. She'd been so thrilled with the exploit that she had knighted Mr. Whitworth, the rifle's inventor, on the spot. Lincoln tapped home the ramrod, working the hand-rolled cartridge into the barrel, then carefully fitted the primer cap over the rifle's nipple. Finally, he removed the brass tampon on the barrel and stretched a condom over the muzzle to protect the barrel from dust and moisture. With his weapon ready to fire, Lincoln crouched at the sill to study the target building across the street from what had once been the Carson C. Peck Memorial Hospital. Lincoln had made use of one of Martin Odom's old tricks to find the address that corresponded to the unlisted phone number 718-555-9291. He'd called the local telephone company from a booth on Eastern Parkway. A woman had come on the line. Like Martin in London, Lincoln had retrieved Dante Pippin's rusty Irish accent for the occasion.
"Could you tell me then how I can get my hands on a new phone book after my dog chewed the bejesus out of the old one?"
"What type of directory do you want, sir?"
"Yellow Pages for Brooklyn."
"We'll be glad to send it to you. Could I trouble you for your phone number?"
"You're not troubling me," Lincoln had said. "It's 718-555-9291.
The woman had repeated the number to be sure she had it right. Then she'd asked,
"What kind of dog do you have?"
"An Irish setter, of course."
"We'll hide the phone book from him next time. Will you be needing anything else today?"
"A new Yellow Pages will do me fine. Are you sure you know where to send it?"
The woman had said, "Let me check the screen. Here it is. You're at 621 Crown Street, Brooklyn, New York, right?"
"That's it, darling."
"Have a nice day."
"I plan to," Lincoln had said just before he hung up.
From his hideaway on the fourth floor of the abandoned and soon-to-be-demolished hospital, Lincoln watched a black teenager balancing a ghetto blaster on one shoulder skate past 621 Crown Street. As dusk shrouded the neighborhood and the streetlights flickered on, what Lincoln took to be a group of Nicaraguans in dreadlocks and colorful bandanas piled out of a gypsy cab and filed into the building. Settling down to camp for the night, Lincoln examined the building across the street more closely through the scope on the rifle. All the windows on the first five floors had cheap shades, some of them drawn, some of them half-raised. The people he caught glimpses of in the windows looked to be Puerto Ricans or blacks. The entire top floor appeared to have been taken over by the target. Every window was fitted with Venetian blinds, all but one tightly closed. The one where he could see through the slats turned out to be a kitchen, equipped with an enormous Frigidaire and a gas stove with a double oven. A stocky black woman wearing an apron appeared to be preparing dinner. Now and then men would wander through the kitchen. One of them had his sports jacket off, and Lincoln could make out a large caliber pistol tucked into a shoulder holster. The black woman opened the oven to baste a large bird, then prepared two enormous bowls of dog food. She seemed to shout to someone in another room as she set the bowls down on the floor. A moment later, two borzois romped into sight and were promptly lost to view under the sill of the window. Clearing away the debris, settling down on the floor with his back against a wall, Lincoln treated himself to a Mars bar and half a container of yogurt. All things considered, he was relieved that he was the one doing the shooting and not Martin Odom. Marksmanship was not Martin's strong suit.
He was too impatient to stalk a target and crank in one or two clicks on the sights for distance and windage, and slowly squeeze, as opposed to jerk, the trigger. Too cerebral to kill in cold blood unless he was goaded into action by the likes of Lincoln Ditman or Dante Pippin. In short, Martin was too involved, too temperamental. When a born-again sniper like Lincoln shot at a human target, the only thing he felt was the recoil of the rifle. Staking out the target, taking your sweet time to be sure you got the kill, one shot to a target, Lincoln was in his element. He had owned a rifle since he was a child in Pennsylvania, hunting rabbits and birds in the woods and fields behind his house in Jonestown. Once packed off to the company's farm for a refresher course in hand-to-hand combat and firearms, he'd impressed the instructors the first day on the firing range when they'd put an antiquated gas-operated semi-automatic M1 in his hands. Without a word, Lincoln had screwed down the iron sights and fired off a round at the 36-inch target, hoping to spot a spurt of dirt somewhere in front of it. When he did, he'd turned up the sights one click, which was the equivalent of 1 minute of elevation or 10 inches of height on the target, and fired the second round into the black. He'd notched in a one-click windage adjustment and raised his sights and hit the bullseye on the third try. The cold set in with the darkness. Lincoln turned up the collar of Martin Odom's overcoat and, drawing it tightly around his body, dozed. Images of soldiers outfitted in white headbands charging a stone wall along a sunken road filled his brain. He could hear the spurt of cannon and the crackle of rifle fire as smoke and death drifted over the field of battle. He forced himself awake to check the luminous hands on his wristwatch and the building across the street. Falling into a fitful sleep again, he found himself transported to a more serene setting. Skinny girls in filmy dresses were slotting coins into a jukebox and swaying in each other's arms to the strains of Don't Worry, Be Happy. The music faded, and Lincoln found himself inhaling the negative ions from a fountain on the Janicular, one of Rome's seven hills. An elegantly dressed woman and a dwarf wearing a knee-length overcoat buttoned up to his neck were walking past. Lincoln could hear himself saying, "My name's Ditman. We met in Brazil in a border town called Foz do Iguaçu. Your daytime name was Lucha. Your nighttime name was Paura." He made out the woman's excited response.
"I remember you. Your daytime name happens to be the same as your nighttime name, which is Giovanni da Varzano."
In his fiction, Lincoln caught up with the woman as she continued on down the hill. He gripped her shoulders and shook her until she agreed to spend the rest of her life breeding baby polyesters with him on a farm in Tuscany. Checking the building across the street again, Lincoln became aware of the first faint ochreous stains tinting the grim sky over the roofs in the east. Setting up the kill had been easier than he'd expected. He'd made his way through the alleyways behind Albany Avenue to the yard in back of Singh's restaurant. Using an old boat hook hidden behind a rusting refrigerator, he'd tugged down the lower rung of the ladder on the fire escape and climbed up to the roof. The bees had long since abandoned Martin's two hives, including the one that seemed to have exploded. Stains of what looked like dried molasses were visible on the tar paper. Retrieving the key Martin had hidden behind a loose brick on the parapet, Lincoln had unlocked the roof door and let himself into Martin Odom's pool parlor. He made his way through the dark apartment to the pool table that Martin had used as a desk and took a single hand-rolled rifle cartridge from the mahogany humidor. Lincoln himself had fabricated the ammunition several years before, procuring high-grade gunpowder and measuring it out on an apothecary scale. Pocketing the cartridge, he picked up the Whitworth and blew the dust off of its firing mechanism. It was a surprisingly light weapon, beautifully crafted, exquisitely balanced, a delight to hold in your hands. This particular Whitworth had originally been his. He couldn't remember how it had wound up in Martin Odom's possession. He made a mental note to ask him one of these days. Wiping the weapon clean of fingerprints, he rolled it in one of Martin's overcoats and slung it across his back. Then, pulling on a pair of thick work gloves he found in a cardboard box, he retraced his steps down to the alley, recovered the shopping bag filled with nourishment that he'd prepared that morning, and meandered through the deserted streets of Crown Heights to the massive building with Carlson C. Peck Memorial Hospital and 1917 engraved in its stone base. Breaking in turned out to be relatively uncomplicated. At the back of the hospital, on the Montgomery Street side, squatters had cut through the chain-link fence the demolition company rigged around the property, and one of the ground-floor doors was ajar. Crouching inside the building to get his bearings, Lincoln caught the muffled sound of a brassy cough rising from the stairwell, which suggested that the squatters had installed themselves in the basement of the building. The ochreous streaks had dragged smudges of daylight across the sky, transforming the rooftops into silhouettes.
Massaging his arms to work out the coldness and the stiffness, Lincoln pushed himself to his feet and padded over to a corner of the room to relieve himself against a wall. Returning to the window, kneeling at the sill, he noticed a light in the top-floor kitchen window across the street. The black woman, wrapped in a terrycloth robe, was brewing up two large pots of coffee. When the coffee was ready, she filled 8 mugs and, carrying them on a tray, disappeared from view. Below, at the entrance to 621 Crown, 2 Nicaraguan women wearing long winter coats and bright scarves and knitted caps pulled down over their earlobes emerged from the building and hurried off in the direction of the subway station on Eastern Parkway. 12 minutes later, a black BMW pulled up to the curb in front of the tenement. The driver, a tall man in a knee-length leather overcoat and a chauffeur's cap, climbed out and stood leaning against the open door, clouds of vapor streaming from his mouth as he breathed. He glanced at his watch several times and stamped his feet to keep them from growing numb. He checked the number over the entrance of the building against something written on a scrap of paper and seemed reassured when he spotted the 2 men shouldering through the heavy door of 621 into the street. Both were dressed in double-breasted pea jackets with the collars turned up. The men, obviously bodyguards, greeted the driver with a wave. One of the bodyguards strolled to the corner and looked up and down Albany Avenue. The other walked off several paces to his left and checked out Crown Street. Returning to the BMW, he eyed the windows of the deserted hospital across the street. The security arrangements were clearly casual. The bodyguards were going through the motions, but there was no urgency to their gestures, which is what often happened when the individual being protected has been squirreled away, and the people responsible for his safety assumed that potential enemies wouldn't be able to find his hole. Back at the BMW, the 2 bodyguards and the driver were making small talk. One of the bodyguards must have detected a signal on his walkie-talkie because he hauled it from a pocket and, looking up at a closed Venetian blind, muttered something into it. Several minutes went by. Then the front door of 621 swung open again and another bodyguard appeared. He was straining to hold back 2 borzois attached to long leashes. To the amusement of the men waiting near the BMW, the dogs practically dragged the man into the gutter. Behind him, a stubby, hunch-shouldered man with a shock of silver hair and dark glasses materialized at the front door. He had a cigar clamped between his teeth and walked with the aid of 2 aluminum crutches, thrusting one hip forward and dragging the leg after it, then repeating the movement with the other hip. He paused for breath when he reached the end of the walkway in front of the building's entrance. One of the bodyguards opened the back door of the car. In the corner room across the street, Lincoln rose to his feet and, in one flowing motion, jammed his left elbow into his rib cage as he steadied the rifle on a window sash. Closing his left eye, he pressed his right eye to the telescopic sight and walked up the muzzle of the Whitworth until the crosshairs were fixed on the target's forehead immediately above the bridge of his nose. He squeezed the trigger with such painstaking deliberation that the eruption of flame at the breech's nipple and the bullet rifling out of the barrel and the satisfying recoil of the stock into his shoulder blade all caught him by surprise. Sighting again on the target, he saw blood oozing from a ragged-edged tear in the middle of the man's forehead. The bodyguards had heard a sound but not yet associated it with gunfire. The one holding open the back door of the car was the first to notice that their charge was collapsing onto the pavement. He leapt forward to catch him under the armpits and, shouting for help, lowered him to the ground. By the time the bodyguards realized that the man they were protecting had been shot dead, Lincoln, oblivious to the spasms in his game leg, was well on his way to the breach in the chain-link fence. 1997. Crystal Quest comes to believe in Dante's Trinity. Dante Pippin, a maestro of tradecraft, had positioned himself in a booth at the rear of Sing's Mandarin restaurant with his back to the tables, facing a mirror in which he could keep track of who came and went. He sized up the 2 figures in trench coats who entered the restaurant at the stroke of noon. Both had the deadpan eyes that marked them as flunkies for the CIA's Office of Security. The one with the cauliflower ears of a prizefighter ducked behind the bar to make sure that So Sing, who was holding fort on his high stool in front of the cash register, didn't have a sawed-off shotgun stashed under the counter. Ignoring Dante, the second man, who had the shoulders and neck of a weightlifter, pushed through the swinging doors into the kitchen. Moments later, he reappeared and planted himself in front of the doors, his arms folded across his barrel chest. It wasn't long before Crystal Quest turned up at the door of the restaurant. Coming into the murky interior from the dazzling sunlight of Albany Avenue, she was momentarily blinded. When she could see again, she spotted Dante and started toward him, the thick heels of her sensible shoes drumming on the linoleum floor. "Long time no see," she said as she slid onto the banquette opposite him. "As usual, you look fit as a flea, Dante. Still working out on that rowing machine? Dante managed a half-hearted laugh. You're confusing me with Martin Odom, Fred. He's the one with the rowing machine. Quest, who knew a joke when she heard one, grinned nervously. Dante said, How about treating your bloodstream to a shot of alcohol? Alcohol's just what the doctor ordered. Something with a lot of ice, thank you. Dante called for a whiskey, neat, and a frozen daiquiri, heavy on the ice. Zo waved his good arm in acknowledgement. Waiting for the drinks, Dante watched Quest toying absently with the frills down the front of her dress shirt. He noticed that the jacket of her pantsuit, like the skin around her eyes, was wrinkled, that the rust-colored dye was washing out of her hair, revealing soot-gray roots. You look the worse for wear, Fred. Job getting you down? Being DDO of an intelligence entity that has recast itself as a risk-averse high-tech social club is not a cakewalk, she said. There are people at Langley who do nothing but stare at satellite downloads from morning to night, as if a photograph could tell you what an adversary intends to do with what he has. Hell of a way to run an espionage agency. They've slashed our budget, the president doesn't have the time or the curiosity to read the overnight briefing book we prepare for him, the liberal press climbs all over us for our occasional fumbles. It goes without saying we can't gloat about our occasional successes. The Chinese waitress, wearing a tight skirt slit up one thigh, set the drinks on the table. Watching the girl slink away in the mirror reminded Dante of Martin's late lamented Chinese girlfriend, Min. Do you have any? He asked Quest. Crunching on chips of ice, she lost the thread of the conversation. Have any what? She inquired. Successes. One or two or three. Like the Prigorodnaya business, Dante murmured. Quest's eyes hardened. What Prigorodnaya business are you talking about? Christ's sake, Fred, don't play the innocent, Dante snapped. We know what happened to Yosef Kafkor. We know the DDO provided seed money to the Armenian used car dealer so he could corner the Russian aluminum market. We know how Ugor Zhilov, a.k.a. the oligarch, ingratiated himself with Yeltsin, arranging for the publication of his book, organizing his personal bodyguard, replenishing his bank account. Once installed in Yeltsin's inner circle, the oligarch nudged him into freeing up prices and privatizing the industrial base of the defunct Soviet Union. We know he lured Yeltsin into attacking Chechnya just when the Red Army was recovering from the Afghanistan debacle. We know that for a period of years in the early 90s, the individual running Russia from behind the scene was none other than Fred Astaire. We know she was running it into the ground so that the new Russia rising from the ashes of the Soviet Union couldn't compete with America. The blood seemed to seep from Quest's cheeks until the only color remaining came from the smears of blush-on she'd applied during the shuttle flight from Washington. She spooned another chunk of ice into her mouth. "Who's we?" she demanded. "Why, I would have thought that was obvious. There's Martin Odom, the one-time CIA field agent turned detective who specializes in collecting Mahjong debts. There's Lincoln Ditman, the Civil War buff, who actually met the poet Whitman. And last but certainly not least, there's yours truly, Dante Pippin, the Irish dynamiter from Castletown Bear." Quest snickered bitterly. That business of Lincoln claiming to have been at the Battle of Fredericksburg, it was a brilliant piece of theater. It had us all fooled, the shrink, me, the committee that met from time to time to review the situation, to decide whether to terminate your contract or your life. We all assumed that Martin Odom was off his rocker. Teach me to give someone the benefit of the doubt. Nursing his whiskey, Dante shrugged a shoulder. If it's any consolation, Lincoln was at the Battle of Fredericksburg. Quest raised an eyebrow. She didn't appreciate having her leg pulled. Why'd you need to see me, Dante? What's so important that it couldn't wait until you had a chance to come down to Langley? We've taken out life insurance. We've taped what you don't want the world to know, the Prigorodnaya operation. How you provided the keys to Kastner's safe house so the oligarch's people could break in and murder him. How you told them about Martin's beehives, which led to the death of the Chinese girl Min. Add to that the sniper who tried to kill Martin in Hebron. Not to mention the Czechs who gave Martin a car and pistol in Prague and told him to run for it. These attempts on Martin's life had your prints all over them. That's nonsense. Knowing what I know, the last thing I would have done is charge a pistol with dummy parabellums. Dante said, How did you know the handgun was loaded with dummy parabellums? Quest smudged a fingertip, dabbing at the mascara on an eyelid. Dante took her failure to answer for an answer. Listen up, Fred. If any one of us dies of anything but old age, the tapes will be duplicated and distributed to every member of the Congressional Oversight Subcommittee, also to selected journalists in the liberal press who report on your occasional fumbles. You're bluffing. Dante raised his chin and looked Quest in the eye. If you think that, all you need to do is call our bluff.
Listen, Dante, we all came of age in the Cold War. We all fought the good fight. I'm sure we can work something out. There's one more item on our agenda. We had a meeting to decide whether to terminate your life or your career. Career 1, 2-1. Within 1 week, we want to read in the newspapers that the legendary Crystal Quest, the first woman deputy director of operations, a veteran of 32 years of loyal and masterful service to the Central Intelligence Agency, has been put out to pasture. Sucked against her will into Dante's Trinity, Quest asked, "Who was the one who voted to terminate my life?" "Why, Martin, of course. Though being the more squeamish of the three, he wanted me or Lincoln to make the hit." Dante smiled pleasantly. "Some people forgive but don't forget. Martin's the opposite. He forgets but doesn't forgive." "What does he forget?" "Whether Martin Odom is a legend or the real him." "It's the original him, the first legend. You worked for Army Intelligence." "You mean Martin worked for Army Intelligence?" Quest nodded carefully. "Martin's specialty was East European dissidents. I stumbled across a paper he published in the Army Intelligence Quarterly identifying two veins of dissidents. The anti-communists, who wanted to do away with communism altogether, and the pro-communists, who wanted to purge communism of Stalinism and reform the system. His article, which turned out to be far-sighted, predicted that in the end the pro-communists were more likely to have an impact on East Europe and ultimately the Soviet Union itself than the anti-communists. I remember Martin citing the trial of Pavel Slansky in Prague, claiming he was the precursor of the reformers who came after him, Dubček in Czechoslovakia, eventually Gorbachev in the Soviet Union. And you lured him away from Army Intelligence into the CIA? The Legend Committee worked up a cover for him using his real name and as much of his actual background as they could. He'd lived in Pennsylvania until his father moved the family to Brooklyn. Martin was something like 8 at the time. He was raised on Eastern Parkway. He went to PS 167. Crown Heights was his stamping ground. He even had a school chum whose father owned a Chinese restaurant on Albany Avenue. When we discovered he could handle explosives, for a while we had him making letter bombs or rigging portable phones to explode from a distance. Martin was the last agent I personally ran before they kicked me upstairs to run the officers who run the agents. The Odom we concocted wasn't a detective. That's something Martin added to the cover story when his company career came to an end. Quest, shaken, began gnawing on a chip of ice. Dante tucked a $10 bill under the ashtray and stood up. "I'll pass all this along to Martin if I see him. I suspect he'll be relieved." Quest looked up at Dante. "It was you who shot the oligarch." "Christ's sake, Fred. I knew it was you, Dante. The kill had your M.O. on it." Dante laughed lightly, his shoulders shuddering with pleasure. "You're losing your touch, Fred. Oh, I have nothing to gain by lying to you. It was Lincoln who made the hit on the oligarch. Newspaper accounts said the police couldn't identify the bullet or the murder weapon, which means Lincoln must have used that old Civil War sniper rifle you found for him when you were working up the Dittman legend. Jesus, that's really humorous. Martin or I wouldn't know how to load the damn thing." Snickering in satisfaction, Dante headed for the front of the restaurant. The weightlifter came off the kitchen doors and started after him. The prizefighter edged around the bar to block his path. Zhou Xing called in a high-pitched voice, "No violence inside, all right." Dante's Irish temper flared. Glancing over his shoulder at Quest, he said very softly, "Am I to understand that you'll be calling our bluff, Fred?" Quest locked eyes with Lincoln, then looked away and took a deep breath and wagged a forefinger once. The two flunkies from the Office of Security stopped in their tracks. Dante nodded as if he were digesting a momentous piece of information, something that could transform his legend and add to his longevity. Humming under his breath one of Lincoln's favorite tunes, "Don't Worry, Be Happy," he pushed through the door into the blinding sunlight.
Production copyright 2005. All rights reserved. The Audio Partners Publishing Corporation is also pleased to be the publisher of other classic suspense novels, including The Third Man by Graham Greene, The Statement by Brian Moore, and The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett. For a free audio editions catalog offering thousands of audiobooks on cassette and compact disc from all major publishers, call toll-free 1-800-231-4261. Visit our website at www.audioeditions.com.